This evening we're going to be talking about exegetical fallacies. There's what are some things that you can fall off the track on as you study the Word of God. And let me give you the definition of a couple words. One is called eisegesis. You may never have heard that before. Another one is called exegesis. Eisegesis means reading into. And exegesis has the idea of reading out of. Now, which one of those do you think we want to be involved in as we're studying the Bible? We want to be getting something out of the Bible, not reading something into the Bible. And so many times when people approach the Scriptures, they are involved in eisegesis. They want to go to a passage and make it say what they want to fit what they want. Instead, we want to be looking at the passage and letting it speak for us. So we need to insist with ourselves and with each other on exegesis. Reading out of the text what's there, and insist on not having eisegesis. And that's one of the values of brotherhood, so that we can help each other not fall into that trap. Let me give you some examples of eisegesis. You remember how Jesus was struggling in the garden? And it says his sweat was like great drops of blood. His agony was so great, it was sweat like great drops of blood falling to the ground. There's one view that says, well, the struggle with Satan in the garden was so great that it affected Jesus physically, and so his body began to deteriorate, and he's sweating sweat like great drops of blood, and he was afraid he would die in the garden before he had a chance to go to the cross and die where he was supposed to, and so he prayed that God would save him from death. Does that sound like exegesis or eisegesis? Eisegesis. I mean, that's reading something into the text. There is not a word in the text about Jesus having a struggle with Satan in the garden. And people read things in like that, and somebody says, oh, yes, that sounds great. We have to watch out for that happening. That kind of thing happens over and over. Or have you ever heard this one? Bobbed hair, cut hair for women, was a sign of harlots in ancient Corinth. And Paul, of course, didn't want Christians to be mistaken for harlots. And so he says that they should have long hair. But in America, having bobbed hair is not a sign necessarily of being a harlot. So it's not relevant for us. Have you ever heard that kind of logic? What about this? Bobbed hair in ancient Corinth is a sign of harlots. How do you deal with it? First of all, that is eisegesis right there. Because Paul says absolutely nothing about harlots in Corinth being something that he doesn't want the Christian church to be mistaken for by having the wrong kind of hairdo. He doesn't talk about that at all. So that is reading that idea into that question. Paul mentions nothing of the kind. What Paul does talk about is the reference to the Godhead, the reference to creation, the reference to the accepted order of things, various things that are transcultural. And so it is eisegesis to talk about this. But in addition, there is no Greek text that we know of in existence that ever says such a thing, that bobbed hair was a mark of Corinthian harlots. None. So when somebody confronts you with that kind of nonsense, say, sir, please tell me, where in all of the Greek literature in our history of the world do you have a document that says such a thing? They won't be able to produce it. Now, where does this stuff arise from? I can imagine how it works. This is just speculation on my part. But can you imagine? Somebody says, well, probably Paul, maybe in a footnote in a commentary, probably Paul didn't want Christians to be mistaken as harlots, and so he gave this prohibition or gave this suggestion. Well, then someone reads that commentary and sees that in the footnote and thinks that's pretty good, and so they write a commentary and they put it right in the text that, you know, It seems that Paul didn't want this to happen. And someone else may read that and put it in a Sunday school book and say that, you know, one of these eminent authorities who wrote such and such a book said that this was a practice of Corinthian harlots and therefore we shouldn't be doing the same kind of thing. You can see how that kind of thing arises. You know why we have to come back to the text itself over and over again? Because the text itself is what we're going by. We're not going by the fact that the church fathers may have said this or that. Sometimes it's useful to check the church fathers to see what they said. Sometimes what they said is plain nonsense. Remember that. But sometimes what people say today is plain nonsense. How do we check it? We check it by going back to the Bible itself. Isaiah's call and message. I mentioned this a little bit. Isaiah chapter 6, verses 8 and 9. I heard a sermon preached where that was supposed to be a gospel missionary text. Well, when you look at the whole context with Isaiah chapter 5, pronouncing the woes on the wicked in Israel, and then how long he's supposed to preach until there is no inhabitant, it was a message of judgment, not a gospel message. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 15. It talks about if the unbeliever depart out of a marriage, let him depart. The Christian is not under bondage in such cases. And so what do people say? Well, you're not under bondage, then you're free to remarry. That's what people say. You know what that is? It's eisegesis. Because that word means the Christian is not enslaved in such cases. The word does not mean bondage in the sense of a marriage bond. And besides, to say that would contradict chapter 7, verse 11. So you see, you have the context right there in the book itself that tells you that is reading into the text instead of reading out of the text. You see, if you really want to stumble over something, the Bible is written in a way that you will find what you want to stumble over. What are some fallacies regarding Greek word study? You know, people love to say, well, the Greek says this, or the Hebrew says this. For example, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1. Let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. The word, therefore, servant is the Greek word huperetas. And if you would take that Greek word apart, literally it means under rower. Under rower, like rowing a boat. Under rower. And so somebody has popularized this idea. Well, you know those old Greek ships, when they were having a battle, there were fellows down there in the bottom of that ship rowing. You know, and they couldn't see anything. They knew where they were going. But the guys up to the front of this group down there in that bottom part of the ship where they can't see anything, he knows what's supposed to happening. And so he'll tell these guys on the right, row! Now, left, row! And so they can maneuver that boat around. They don't know where they're going. They're just going places they're told to go. They're just under rowers. You see? And as they follow those directions exactly, then this ship can ram that other ship and win the battle. And so we are servants of Christ. We are under rowers. We don't really know what's going on. We just follow Christ's commands. And doesn't that sound pious and wonderful? The word, when you tear it apart like that, is under rower, but it means servant. Now, let's try it out in English. How many of you have a cupboard at home? Anybody? Oh, that's a cupboard, right? It's a board you put cups on. Is that right? It's a cupboard. Now, it may be that years ago, that's how the word originated. I don't know. You know, there's a board on this wall that you put cups on. So that's a cupboard. Well, then somebody decided, well, okay, let's put some sides on that thing and let's put a door on that thing so that you can stick those cups in there and nobody can know how dirty they are. And we still call it a cupboard. And whenever anybody thinks about it, and you talk about a cupboard, we're not thinking about a cupboard, are we? It just means cupboard to us, a place where you put not only cups, but what else? Other things. Dishes. Or try this one. Have you ever heard of a fruit called a pineapple? What is that? It is an apple that grows on pine trees, isn't it? Now, do you see what utter nonsense this is? It is utter nonsense in English. But people love to grab Greek words and tear them apart and say, look at this. This word plus this word means this. And so therefore, da, 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 da. What is that a bad example of? Eisegesis. It is nonsense. Now, it's possible sometimes that compound Greek words have a different meaning. For example, the word balo in Greek means to throw or cast. And ekbalo can mean throw out or cast out. That's true. We have words that mean something like that, don't we? In English, we have a word called flammable. And we have a word called inflammable. What does it mean? Is that the same or different? You see, languages do funny things, don't they? So isn't it funny that flammable and inflammable are the same meaning? See, sometimes in English, when you put a prefix on there, it changes the meaning. And in that case, in English, it doesn't change the meaning. So sometimes you can have situations like that in various languages, and you don't go to a word in a language and tear it apart into two chunks and look at those two chunks and say, therefore, this word means the sum total of these two chunks. Another Greek word fallacy that people are guilty of is taking a late meaning and imposing it earlier. For example, in Romans chapter 1, verse 16, it says, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. And the word translated power is the Greek word dunamis. You have any idea what word in English is related to that Greek word dunamis? Dynamite. And so some people get up and they preach, the gospel is the dynamite of God. Wait a minute. Was Paul thinking about that when he wrote that? Is the gospel the dynamite of God? Is that what Paul was thinking? Is Paul thinking about a constructive force or a destructive force? Which is it? Constructive. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. It transforms somebody who's a wretched, miserable scoundrel into what? Someone who can live from faith to faith, as the next verse is talking about. Well, where did this word dynamite come from? It comes from the word dunamis. But when did it come from it? Within the last 200 years. So you see, Paul wasn't thinking about dynamite at all. But people love to do things like that. Don't be enticed by them. 1 John 1, verse 7, the blood of Christ cleanses us from every sin. So sometimes people will say, oh, did you ever think about how the blood in the body cleanses the body? You know, it takes away the toxins and sends them off to the kidneys and, you know, it does all these things and it removes the carbon dioxide and carries the oxygen to the body and all that. See, the blood is a cleansing agent. Is that what that means when it says the blood of Christ cleanses us from all sin? No, it's not. When it says the blood of Christ, what is it really referring to? Is there something magical about Jesus' physical blood? The answer is no. The blood of Christ is another way of saying what thing? The death, the sacrificial, violent death of Christ on our behalf. Or an appeal to unlikely meanings. For example, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 34. It's another verse that some people don't care for too much. It says, let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are also to be submissive, as the law also says. I know of one author that said that word law refers not to the Old Testament law, but to rabbinic additions. Well, wait a minute. There's no evidence in the text that that's true. Now, we know that the Bible, when it speaks about law, sometimes speaks about different things. Sometimes it's the law and the prophets. That would be like the Mosaic law and then the prophets. Or sometimes it might mean a principle. There are various ways that law can be used. But you cannot just come along and decide, well, I think it means this. The context has to give you the indication that it means that. There are also foolish statements regarding language. Sometimes people will say this, the Greek New Testament is written in the language of the Holy Ghost. What do you think of that idea? The fact of the matter is, it is absolutely false, because the papyrus fragments that you can find in the ancient cities that have New Testament Greek on them, now I'm not talking about New Testament text, but New Testament type Greek, shows that it was used for ordinary conversation and transaction. It's just as ordinary a language as German and French and Chinese. Some people say things like this, but Greek is so much more expressive than English. You know, things are expressed in different ways in different languages. In fact, English has a vast vocabulary. It has a bigger vocabulary than probably any other language in the world. It has borrowed words from so many different places. I mean, think about the number of words that we have to express he went. He ran, he walked, he shuffled, he hurried, he trotted, he hustled. And there's more yet besides, I'm sure. And sometimes people think the German is better than the English. Oh, the German Bible. Now that's really the good one. It expresses it so much more deeply and so much better. Well, there might be places where Luther did a better job than the King James translators. That's possible. But there also can be some places where the King James translators did a better job than Luther. We've got to remember that. We've got to be fair. You know, so many false things come out of Bible studies because people are not fair. We've got to be just with the facts. We've got to be fair. We've got to be just. We've got to be honest when we deal with this text. There are false claims regarding the significance of words. Have you ever heard this? Divine love is agape. Human love is phileo. I'm using two Greek words here. There are people who say that. Wait a minute. Test it out. Don't just take it for granted. Humans can have agape love in an evil way. For example, 1 John 2:15, love not the world. That's talking about agape love. God does exercise agape love, John 3:16. God so loved the world, agape. God also loves the Son this way. The Father loves the Son, John 3:35. But God also exercises phileo love. The Father loves the Son, phileo, John 5:20. In fact, John 16:27 talks about the mutual love between us and persons of the Trinity. Revelation 3:19, it talks about Jesus chastens those he loves, and the word is phileo. Do you see what I'm getting at? When you're told things like this, get on your Wigram's Englishman's Greek Concordance and look it up and see if it's true that God is the only one who loves with agape, etc., etc., etc. The other error is to claim that there is no difference in meaning in synonyms. I mean, some places the text uses agape and some places it uses phileo. And if it's used nearby in the same text, then a person who says, well, it's just two synonyms, that doesn't mean any difference, it's up to them to prove that it doesn't mean any difference if you have two different words. The burden of proof is on them. I mean, think about this. If I would say in English, I like my wife, or I would say I adore my wife, is there any difference between like and adore? Do they mean the same thing? Well, sort of. But there's a much different flavor of it, isn't it? And you see, that's the way words work. Words that are even synonyms are not exactly alike. And so I'm inclined to say if he's talking about in the same paragraph, and one place he's using agape, another place he's using phileo, there must be something going on here. And some people say, well, that's just a stylistic literary technique. He didn't want to use the same word all the time. Well, sometimes that happens. We don't want to always use the same word all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. But in general, when people use different words that are synonyms, they're doing it for a reason. Now, I'll give you an example of one that there is debate about. John chapter 20. John chapter 20, verse 15. Jesus is talking to Simon Peter, and he says, Simon, son of Jonah, do you agape love me more than these? He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." Verse 16, he said to him a second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you agape love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." Verse 17, he said to him the third time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you phileo love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you phileo love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I..." Phileo, love you. I'm not ready to discount all those different words to say he's just doing it for variety. You see, Peter is grieved, I believe, because the third time Jesus said, "Do you phileo love me?" In other words, do you have affection for me? You could read it like Jesus was asking, "Do you love me?" He says, "Yes, I have affection for you." "Do you love me?" "Yes, I have affection for you." "Peter, do you have affection for me?" Then he's grieved. There are grammatical errors. Have you ever heard people say this? Well, this part in the Greek text is the aorist tense. And the aorist means point action. It's something that happened once and that was it. You ever heard that argument? You know, that is a very fallacious argument. It may be that it happened once and it was it. But just because it's in the aorist tense does not mean it just happened once and that was it. You see the difference between it may be and it is. For example, as you have always obeyed, Philippians 2:12, aorist tense. That doesn't mean always obeyed just once for all. Revelation 20, verse 4, they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. They lived, aorist tense, and they reigned 1,000 years. It's just saying this happened. Verse 23 of Romans 3, all have sinned, aorist tense. Does that mean every person just sinned one time, boom, that was it? Of course not. God loved us, Ephesians 2, verse 4. Did God love us just once at one point and that was it? In fact, John 3:16, God so loved the world, aorist tense. What I'm getting at is people make these grandiose statements that simply are not true. It is very common. Or people will talk about the use of the article in Greek. In English, we have the definite article, which is the word the, like the cat. And we have an indefinite article, a cat. But in Greek, you only have the definite article or the absence of the definite article. So you can see that immediately Greek uses the articles different than how we do. Well, then that means the absence or presence of the article in Greek isn't necessarily exactly equivalent to it in English. And people get into various kinds of heresies by making assumptions. In fact, the Jehovah's Witness loves to take John 1:1 and say, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God," because the article is not there. And then, see, that's what it means. It is not what it means. And it would take some time to refute all of that. But what I'm saying is that's another exegetical fallacy. Now, do you notice what's happening here? Someone said that a little Greek is a dangerous thing. Often people will learn a little bit of Greek, and then and they've learned to look it up in Strong's Concordance, maybe, and they can read a Greek word and say, "Oh, the Greek says this." Now, wait a minute. How do we know what the Greek actually says? If you look up in a lexicon, there might be 5 different words there under this one Greek word. Which one does it mean? Does it mean all of those? Does it mean just one? The answer is, it means probably just one of those things in that context. It can't mean all 5 of those things at once, usually. Did I give you the example about the catching the fly at the park? See, it either means an insect or it means a ball, right? But it can't mean both of them at once. The context will make it clear. And so we aren't free to just pick any definition we like. But see, that's what people love to do. They'll go and find some lexicon, and it has five definitions in there. Oh, the one I like is that one. That's what we're going to use. That is totally wrong. Because the context determines the meaning of that word in that statement. One of the keys to insights from Greek is understanding the grammar, how it works. And you see, that means you have to understand how to read a whole sentence in Greek. You know, I think in general, if people cannot read a sentence in Greek, they should be quiet about what the Greek says. And if a person can't read a sentence in Greek, you shouldn't pay much attention to what they're saying about Greek. Translators have spent years of their lives studying Greek and trying to understand how to translate that into the target language. That is not an easy job. In fact, the more you understand translation, the more you realize how hard it is. Now, let me tell you something about how Greek works so you understand the importance of understanding the sentence and how the grammar works. Greek has cases. There's nominative, accusative, and dative cases, for example. And the word endings tell you which case it's talking about. English has lost most of the cases. They have a few left. For example, if we say, he ate her, we're using cases. Because he is nominative and her is accusative. Now, if we would say, her, he ate. Or if we'd say, her, ate he. You see how that it's really saying that he still ate her because the case makes it semi-clear. We're not used to doing it this way. And that's why it feels funny. But Greek uses that all the time. So if you have a form that is the object, you can put that anywhere you want in the sentence, and it's always the object. It doesn't matter what the word order is. And if the thing is the subject, it's still the subject, whether you put it after the verb or before. Which means that in Greek, you can move things around from the ordinary order to emphasize certain things. And what you do, you ordinarily have the verb first, and then subject and object. So if you want to emphasize the subject a great deal, you can just pull the subject way up to the front. Whatever you pull up to the front is giving it more emphasis. So for example, John 3:16, what's the emphasis of that verse? Is it, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son? Or is it, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son? Or which is it? How do you know? Now, sometimes people will read through the English text and, in essence, take a guess. Or maybe someone might even say, well, let's just emphasize each word. We can have a sermon for every Sunday for about 6 or 8 Sundays. You know, God so loved the world. So talk about God. He loved the world. Next time we'll talk about love. He loved the world, you know. But wait a minute. Do you see how that becomes eisegesis again? Because we have to read the verse for the emphasis the author wants to put on it. Now, Greek helps us out a little bit here because the grammar can pull to the front the thing it's emphasizing. So when it says in Greek, God so loved the world, it's love and then God and then world. So from what I've told you, that's just the normal word order. It's not emphasizing any one of those particular words. The next phrase, it says, so that the Son, the unique Son, he gave. So that, in other words, so that the only begotten Son, he gave. So what's being emphasized there in that second phrase? Is it the giving or is it this unique Son? Which one? The unique Son. You see, because it pulled that to the front out of the ordinary word order. Now, what I'm telling you about this is, it's those kind of things that help you understand the text, not just running to a lexicon somewhere and picking out some word meaning that you like. That's why it's an illustration of it's important, if you want to get something out of the Greek text, be sure you can read a Greek sentence. And I think we ought to call people to task when they start talking about Greek or Hebrew. And just plain ask them, can you read a sentence for me? If they can't, say, well, you know, sir, I think you know the English much better. And it'll be much clearer to you in English. Just a suggestion. There are logical fallacies. For example, sometimes people will look at a text and they'll say, that's what it says right here. I'll never depart from that. And so that's what it says, so it must always be true. Is that the way the Bible works? There are some things that are always true. God is just. But how about this one? All have sinned. Has that always been true? Not quite. One exception. Who is it? Jesus. Never sinned. And there are lots of places like that. You remember the one we looked at the other night about, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him. And then another verse right beside it, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he become wise in his own eyes. So you see, one, neither of those verses is universally applicable. And so sometimes people will just grab a verse and they say, that's what I stand on, that's what I believe, that's true in all cases, when in fact what it's talking about is something in that paragraph. And that's what we're applying it to. That's what the writer is meaning. He isn't saying that you can take that now and lift it out and apply it everywhere else. Sometimes people get into a fallacy by embracing a good-sounding conjecture rather than checking if it is really true. For example, turn to one in Revelation chapter 6, and there are various commentators that will say this. Revelation 6, verse 2, he's talking about the white horse rider, and it says, he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. And sometimes people will say this, well, he has a bow, but he doesn't have any arrows. So he's threatening war, but he's not actually going to war because he doesn't have arrows. He just conquers by making threats, and you know, then people give in. Well, you know, you can imagine what happens. People hear that, and say, well, yeah, that sounds pretty good. You know, that's insightful. You know what you should do? Check it out in the Bible and see if there are any cases in the Bible where he talks about the bow and he's in an actual warfare and he doesn't mention the arrows. There are lots of cases. For example, Genesis 48, 22. Jacob took land from the Amorite with his sword and his bow. So what do you mean? He was out there with a sword hacking away and waving his bow. Of course not. Joshua 24, verse 12. It said God's deliverance was not through their sword and bow. 2 Samuel 1:22, Jonathan's bow did not turn back. What was he doing, throwing his bow? Choo, got him. How about this one? 1 Kings 22:34, a man drew a bow at random and struck Ahab. Amazing. That was really something. 2 Chronicles 17:17, 200,000 men armed with bow and shield. You see, all you have to do is check the Bible, and it shows you that interpretation was ridiculous. You see what we have again and again? The Bible interprets itself. Another fallacy, people will choose a possible meaning and assume it's the correct meaning. Well, but we know that this Greek word can mean this. And therefore, here's our interpretation. Now, just saying it can mean this doesn't mean it does mean this. It's high time we quit sitting back and letting that kind of nonsense stand. You have to show that it does mean this. For example, I suspect if I'd been at your house, some of you married couples, I could have given this example. I heard him say to his wife, I'm leaving. Don't you think I could probably say that? And so, a possible meaning is what? I'm leaving the marriage and I'm not coming back. Now, that's a possible meaning. Would that be a correct meaning for anybody in this room? What's the answer? No, it would not. But you see, a possible meaning does not prove a thing. We've got to know what the meaning is. And so when somebody says, well, here's a possible way you can translate this word, you have to say to him, wait a minute. It might be possible, but you have to show me that that's what the translation must be in this case. Because of what he's saying in the paragraph, maybe it must be. You have to give him that possibility. Another fallacy is to extract a supposedly good application from a false interpretation. You might wonder, who does that? Well, somebody came to visit me in my house. And the wife said to me, "What do you think is the meaning of this certain passage in Revelation? Revelation chapter 3, where he said to the Laodicean church, verse 15, 'I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth.' What do you think that means?" So I gave a very standard interpretation of what I thought that means. Well, she didn't really like that because somebody had spoken at their church. A minister had spoken. And he said, "Well, we know that Christ never wants someone to be actually spiritually cold." First question should come to your mind is what? Does that sound like exegesis or eisegesis? Do we know that Christ never wants somebody to be spiritually cold? Is that true? Do you know that? Have you always known that? Do you know that from the Bible? You see, those are the questions to think about. But what does he say right here in the text? He says, "I could wish you were cold or hot." So that's pretty suspicious. And what they went on to say was this: we know that Christ doesn't want somebody to be spiritually cold. What he's really talking about here is he wants us to be refreshing to him spiritually, like hot water or cold water. He doesn't want this insipid stuff. You know, they had an aqueduct that came from a far distance to bring water to this town. And so by the time it got there, it was just bleh. And so Christ doesn't want us to be bleh to him. He wants us to be refreshing to him, either hot or cold. And I said, the problem is it doesn't fit with the rest of the verses. Just read them. "Because you say, 'I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing,' and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, blind, poor, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, and you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not appear, and anoint your eyes with eyesight that you may see." You see, it doesn't fit with the rest of that stuff to say that what Jesus really wanted was them to just be refreshing to him. You know what they said? "Well, but I like the application." Too bad. Scrap the application. It's based on a false interpretation. If you take a false interpretation and find a nice, fuzzy, warm application that you like, the devil is very happy. If he can get you to interpret something falsely in order to get a true and valid application, he will be glad to have you interpret things falsely, and then he will help you get an invalid, false application. You see, God is never honored by a supposedly good application of a false interpretation. God is never honored that way. Sometimes people are involved in fallacies because of the King James Version. Now, when I say that, I am not saying the King James is an evil translation. The King James has blessed millions of people over many years. But there are places where the King James gives people the wrong impression. For example, in Philippians chapter 4, it says, "Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand." That's what it says in the New King James, because they corrected the problem. In the King James, it says, "Let your moderation be known to all men." And interestingly enough, every other time that this occurs in the New Testament, four other times, this has the idea of patient or gentle type of thing. In other words, at the other times, the King James translators translated it correctly as either patient or gentle. But for some reason, they translated it here as moderation. I heard a man preach a sermon about the importance of moderation. By the way, it was a topical sermon that was a typical, classical, topical sermon that was just his ideas with Bible verses pasted on it. And one of his chief texts was, guess what? Philippians chapter 4, verse 5, "Let your moderation be known to all men." That's just an example where people get off the track because they are reading a version that is not perfect. Now, when I say that, no version is perfect because it is a terrific job to translate out of one language into another. But some people have a King James only view as if that is the perfect translation and everyone else is not in a perfect translation. The fact of the matter is, here's an example where it is not perfect. And so there are various people that have had a false conclusion based on this verse. How about Acts chapter 28, verse 13? I want you to tell me what it means. Acts chapter 28, verse 13. Someone have a King James Version. Read what it says there in the first sentence. 28, 13. Yes.
And from thence we fetched a compass.
Regium. Okay, that's far enough. From thence we fetched a compass and came to Regium. What does that mean? Well, he fetched a compass. Do we know what a compass is? What is it? Okay, something that gives direction. Does anybody know when the compass that gives direction was invented? It's only in the last several hundred years. The Apostle Paul never had one. So we know it doesn't mean that. Do you see what I'm getting at? People read that glibly, and what pops into their mind? Exactly what you said. Now, what does it say in German? I'm very curious. Do you have your German Bible?
Yeah.
Okay, what's it say?
Daher umschiften, kommen wir in Regium. Daher umschiften, that means fetch the compass. It means they turned around.
Okay, but it doesn't mean fetch the compass, right? It just means they turned around.
Yeah.
See, they went in a circular path. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Okay? And your modern translations fix it. The New King James says, from there we circled round and reached Regium.
Uh-huh.
Now, what I'm getting at is, here's an example where the King James is misleading because it's using Old English, but it's using it in a way with a word that we know, but we have a totally different meaning. When we talk about fetching a compass, we don't think about going around in a circle. Colossians chapter 2, verse 23. Here's an example of something that loses its impact in the King James Version. Would someone read it for me? Colossians 2, verse 23. Read it loud and clear.
Which things have indeed a shoe of wisdom and will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh.
Now, do you know what that said? Does anybody know what that means?
I could never understand it very good in this version, but in the other versions, it made more sense.
That's exactly right. That is incomprehensible, in my opinion, in the King James. Let me read it to you in the New King James. They fixed up the problem. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. You know what a lot of people in the Anabaptist tradition say? Well, if you follow these rules, it'll restrain the flesh. What does this verse say? It has no value. None. That's a very strong statement. Too bad the King James didn't make it clear. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. You know, sometimes I'll just be reading from the New King James at a service, and somebody will meet me after the service who feels like their mission in life is to convert me to the correct version, namely the King James. And so I say to them, well, how about 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12? Tell me, what does that mean? So they turn to it, and they read, and it says, ye are not straitened in us, but ye are straitened in your own bowels. And you should see the look on their faces. They start to hem and haw around, and they say, well, I have to look at the context. I say, well, fine, I'm all for looking at the context. They look at the context, and they still don't know. Imagine giving a new convert that translation. If you want to know what it means, read it in a more modern version. Go ahead and read it in yours. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 12.
You are not restricted by us, but you are restricted in your own affections.
I think you can understand that, right?
Right.
There's another example of a fallacy, a false conclusion based on specific translation. I should have listed the one about gentleness there, probably. But Romans chapter 6, verse 2. Back in 2001, a prominent preacher said that Romans 6:2 is the strongest negative expression in the entire Bible. Because in the King James, it says what? God forbid. The fact of the matter is, there's not any words there that say that in Greek. None of the Greek manuscripts say that at all. The Greek is meganoito, and it means may it never be. Now, you can imagine how the King James were translating, and they wanted to have it very emphatic, and so they said, God forbid. But that's not what the text says. And so somebody came along hundreds of years later and said, this is the most emphatic negative expression in the entire New Testament. He was basing it on what I would call a faulty translation. Another fallacy relates to loss of impact. Sometimes people read the King James and they are familiar with it. They've heard it dozens of times. It uses words they don't use, and they have no idea what it means.
Very familiar with that, the German.
Oh, that happens in the German too. Okay. For example, it talks about something in the New Testament, and it says, not purloining. Have you ever heard that expression? Some of you that don't read the English as much, or hear it as much, wouldn't be as familiar, but not purloining. What does purloining mean? I've asked church leaders what it means. And you know, I've encountered at least one church leader I can think of who didn't know what it meant. Not purloining. He didn't know. It means petty thievery. Not stealing little things. The servant is not to be purloining. Not stealing things. But you see, you can hear that over and over and over. It's in my mind because I heard the King James from the time I was a child. But purloining, it's not a word I use except when I explain things like this. And your children, if they're sitting in that kind of audience, they'll hear it and they'll remember it, but they won't remember what it means. Another example of loss of impact. You know, we've had various children involved in mission activities in dangerous places in the world. For example, we had a couple of daughters who were in armed robbery attack in Nigeria. And as we traveled around and people knew that we had daughters in places like that, sometimes they would say to Rhoda, how can you stand it as a mother to have your daughters in those kind of places? And one day, an elder in a church asked Rhoda how she as a mother copes with her children being abroad in these dangerous places. And Rhoda said this verse encouraged her because in Psalm 68, verse 20, it says, to God the Lord belong escapes from death. And he was shocked. He said, where does it say that? So he looked it up in the King James. And in the King James it says, unto God the Lord belong the issues from death. What in the world does that mean? Now you can see, when you understand the meaning, that it's related to it, but the impact is gone, and this man, who was an elder in the church, where in the world is that verse? Isn't that a pity? You see, if you're reading the Bible in a version that you don't really understand, you are shortchanging yourself, and you don't even know it. That's important to remember. Now, having said that, I'm not saying the King James is evil. You know, the King James only people, they'll say the NIV is evil, and they'll say this other version is of the devil and stuff like that. Those are blasphemous statements. That is not good to say those things. You know, the NIV handles certain situations in a way that I don't think are the best. But I'll guarantee you, if an unbeliever reads through the whole NIV, he can get saved. And he'll understand it better than he would the King James. So let's be careful what we say. One more fallacy that I want to mention in particular is the fallacy of false inference, where you take a certain statement that someone made in Scripture and falsely assume something out of that statement that is not true. That's another example of eisegesis. I want you to turn to John chapter 21, verse 21. John 21, verse 21. Let's back up to 20 to get the context. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper, and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Now, I want you to notice in particular the next verses. "Then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you?" You get it? The apostles were there with Jesus, and Jesus said this certain thing, and because of what he said, they jumped to a conclusion. They jumped to a conclusion, or else the people they told about jumped to the conclusion. In other words, in the apostolic era, right, during the days of the apostles, this report went around that John was not going to die. In other words, Christ would come back, in essence, before John dies. Jesus didn't say any such thing. But that is an example of eisegesis, taking something and reading something into it that isn't there. We have to watch out for that. It can happen to the most well-meaning of us. Another fallacy that happens, I should just mention a couple more, I guess. Failure to differentiate between the two covenants can get you into big exegetical problems. And false principles extracted from narrative. You know, just because certain people did certain things doesn't mean it's right. Lot is called a righteous man, but he offered his two virgin daughters to be ravaged by creeps. That doesn't mean it's right to do something drastic that's wicked to prevent some supposedly worse evil. But you see, people can jump to those kinds of conclusions. So what should we conclude? You know, when you study the Bible, you find something wonderful, and that is God is offering us his higher thoughts. Isn't that a wonderful privilege? He's offering them to us. Now, how can we participate in these higher thoughts? Participating in these higher thoughts takes time. It takes lots of time. You know, if you want to really participate in these higher thoughts, you're going to have to say no to the things you know are wrong. Because when you indulge in things that you know are wrong, it blocks your mind. But you're also going to have to say no to distractions. We live in an age that's so full of distractions. So many things that we can do, getting your attention. But you know, in the last 20 years, the distraction level has increased dramatically with computers and the internet. Now, I have a computer. You know I've got one. It's right here. And if you use it properly, it is a great advantage. But if you use it improperly, it is a great disadvantage. If you use the internet properly, it's a great advantage. But if you use it improperly, it's a disadvantage. But let's think about some of the things on the internet that are not bad in themselves. You know what's the trouble? It can lessen your appetite for the best things. Have you heard of Facebook? You know, where people can connect with their old friends and learn what they're doing and all that stuff? And I'm sure there's some things on Facebook that are okay. I'm sure there's some things that are not okay, too. But let's just suppose that you look at Facebook and you just look for the good things. You just look at the things that are wholesome of friends you want to reconnect with. And hopefully they won't be putting bad stuff on their thing. Let's assume that's all happening. And you do that for 2 hours. Then you shut your computer, and are you going to feel like studying the book of Ephesians? The answer is no, you've lost your appetite. What I'm saying is we have got to watch out what happens to our appetite. You know, the more you do this kind of stuff that I've been talking about this weekend, the more you do it, the more you want it. It's like in the last 5 years, I keep thinking of more and more stuff that I have to really study. Where have I been all my life? You know, there is just so much stuff that I ought to be studying more. Do you want to distract your life from the good stuff, the important stuff, with all this stuff that doesn't matter? Not long ago, I got an email from somebody, and they were telling about what happens in Africa and how that in Africa you have people going from the Iron Age to the Cyber Age in one decade. You know, from the Iron Age is like machines where you're running cars and things like that, to the computer age in one decade. And they are unable to handle this explosion of information that's jumping into their world. Some of it's good, but most of it is bad. And this person made this comment. Personally, I am very thankful to have grown up without TV, and that's what I would want for my children. How to handle well the opportunities and temptations internet access brings is not really something I've had to deal with thus far, as even downloading a smallish email can be a Herculean struggle. But on the tube in general, I agree that as much bad stuff as there is out there, its influence is somewhat tempered by our knowing that it's bad stuff. What is really insidious is the harmless stuff. I've rubbed shoulders with a lot of Americans, and I've learned that the default relaxation activity is to plop down in front of a movie. That is becoming the norm in Nigeria as electricity or little Chinese generators make their way to the remotest villages. But leaving all the evil and questionable stuff aside and considering just the morally neutral stuff, I am loath to join the movie watching movement because I am afraid of falling under its power. I can feel the magnetic pull of the dancing screen, the fascination of the entertainment smorgasbord that sucks 3 hours from your life in one sitting and leaves you with nothing to show for it. I don't want to become a person who needs a mind suppressor in order to relax. I don't want to get in the habit of recreation that does not profit the body or sharpen the mind or build relationships or purify the soul. I believe that we need to use these things that we have very wisely, because we dare not have a situation where we lose the appetite for the best things. And I see that happening over and over. People love to, well, look at this. Look at this video of this tractor trailer rolling over 3 times. Well, by the time you've seen 5 videos of that kind of stuff, how many more do you have to see? I'm not saying it's wrong to watch one of them or even watch 2 of them. But, you know, when you fill your mind with that stuff, you lose your appetite for the really good stuff. So, I challenge you. God says, my thoughts are higher than yours. Trade in your low thoughts. Take mine instead. And he's written them down. And so we can spend more time studying what this book says. And the more we study it, guess what? A person spends their life studying this. And at the end of their life, what do they say? I just scratched the surface. There's no other book like it. Not one. So may the Lord bless you. We enjoy being with you during this weekend. Thank you for your gifts to us. Pray for us that the Lord will open doors of opportunity and wisdom and strength and perseverance in all things. May God bless you.